Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, one of the stories in Orion magazine that looks at how we used to live. It's just a fascinating story. I don't know if you know about this time in American history. I sure didn't. But there was a visionary alternative. The Kellogg Company in 1930 announced that all of its nearly 1,500 workers would move from an 8-hour to a 6-hour workday. If the company ran 4 6-hour shifts instead of 3 8-hour shifts, they would give work and paycheck to the heads of 300 more families in Battle Creek. They wanted to expand the lives of workers. They could spend more time with their families and in their neighborhood and being better public citizens. Well, what happened to all of that? Because now we're working and we're working and we're working and we're working and then some. Jeffrey Kaplan will be joining us, the author of the piece in Orion, in just one moment, and I think you'll find it a really interesting discussion. We are in a pledge drive. It's a very brief drive, and I'm here today with Mike Crane. It is our spring membership drive, and we're here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's very simple. All you have to do is pledge your support at WPR.org, or you can call toll-free at 888. 888-202-2552. Hi, Mike.
Hi, it's good to be
Whoops,
here.
Whoops, get that mic on. Hi.
That helps a lot.
Yeah, it does.
Good to be here and joining another true believer in public radio. We are, and we know that you listening are true believers, and so we, you know, it's time for us to ask for your help. We have a goal this hour of $3,500. Won't you be the first to donate this hour to get us started? Make your pledge now online at WPR.org or toll-free 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552.
How do you make your decisions about politics? Of course, you listen to this show because we do an incredible amount of political discussion. We took the show to Dubuque and had a rip-roaring good time, and I've heard so many listeners say, thank you for doing that. You got us so excited about the political race. Where do you go for information that you can rely on? Is Wisconsin Public Radio one of your sources of information? For some of you, it may be the source. A guest on Wisconsin Public Radio perhaps has influenced your thinking. Have you found yourself thinking about something? I do this every day. I think about something in a new way. You hear multiple points of view on Wisconsin Public Radio, and chances are those points of view have helped solidify your own thoughts on an issue. You value what you hear on the Ideas Network, so please pledge your support securely online at WPR.org or toll-free at 888-202-2552.
Now, of course, normally we ask you to call and participate in the show, and we want you to do that this hour, as every hour. But right now, we're asking you to do something just a little different, talk to someone else, and contribute your financial support. You decide on the amount. Just pledge online at WPR.org or call us at 888-202-2552 to pledge your support. A contribution in any amount will provide essential support for Wisconsin Public Radio and make sure that we're going to be here for years to come. So log on at WPR.org or call toll-free 888-202-2552. Do it right now and make your pledge.
And you may be asking why you should switch from being a WPR listener to a WPR listener contributor, and that's really because you want to make a difference and you want to improve your community. Your membership today not only pays for the programs that you listen to so faithfully, it also creates the opportunity for someone else in your neighborhood to discover WPR. Your contribution of any amount helps keep news, music, call-in programs on the air, and that makes a huge difference in our quality of life in our community, a huge difference. So please join us. The process takes just a few minutes, and the benefits last a long time. Online at WPR.org or toll-free at 888-202-2552.
And we'd love to hear from you right now. And, you know, WPR is listener-supported. Some of the people that called during this last little while and helped us to reach the previous hour's goal included Diane from Waukesha, who said that WPR makes her day. And Mike and Elizabeth, also from Waukesha, said, fabulous programming, great service. Can you join in that chorus with your call right now? 1-800. I'm so used to saying 800. It's 888-202-202. 2552, 888-202-2552, or WPR.org. Help us to raise the $3,500 goal this hour.
All right.
So we need your help right now.
Let's do it. Thanks very much, Mike. Talk to you a little bit later during the course of the hour. We have a fascinating conversation coming up when you're going to learn a lot about when work life was quite different in America and why it is that we're working these days. The latest issue of Orion Nature Culture Place May June issue has a fascinating article about the gospel of consumption. It is written by Jeffrey Kaplan, who's a freelance writer and an activist concentrating on the intersection of democracy, political economy, and ecology. His writing has appeared in the Chicago Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, the Whole Earth Review, Adbusters, the Arizona Star, and the Rocky Mountain News. And his pieces have also appeared in several anthologies, most recently a collection of articles from Orion Magazine, The Future of Nature, Writing on a Human Ecology. He starts the article, and I think we'll start the interview this way, by going back to the year 1919. If you think about it for a moment, private cars, very scarce. Horse-drawn conveyances, still common. Electric streetlights had not yet replaced many of the old gas lights. Home electricity remained largely a luxury item for the wealthy. And just 10 years later, Jeffrey, my goodness, everything changed, didn't it? First of all, hello. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What happened 10 years later?
Well, 10 years later, all of a sudden, most urban houses had electricity and a certain number of appliances, electric flat irons, vacuum cleaners were quite common. And then amongst the middle class, there was a lot more stuff coming around things like, well, weren't a lot of the refrigerators started coming in more, for example. And they had a lot of common little things, things like popcorn poppers were actually available in the 20s, heating pads, coffee percolators. Now, this is mostly the upper classes, not working people. But, again, one of the big things that happened was that radios became common. The first commercial radio station was only around 1920, and by the end of the decade, there was something like, I think it was 1929, they bought almost 4.5 million radios in 1 year alone. And this is in a population of 120 million people.
Best invention ever, right?
It's just keeps going. But
right.
But despite all that, there was a problem on the horizon. First of all, the industrialists weren't really sure they could convince. Americans had been frugal, really.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't really convinced they could get Americans to buy tons of stuff. And probably the bigger problem was that the industrial capacity had reached sort of a tipping point. And what had happened was that the process really started a few decades earlier, but what was happening was that up until then, we've been able to produce. The problem was how could we produce enough goods? The problem changed to becoming overproduction, this tremendous quantity of goods that could be produced, and how are we going to handle that?
Mm-hmm.
So in the 20s, for example, there was a interview with the Secretary of Labor at the time, who said that 14% of the American shoe factories could produce a year's supply of footwear. And so what we had was what the New York Times called needs saturation.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was speculation, what we would now call the mainstream press, that people might only need to work 3 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So businessmen were not real keen on that idea. And President Hoover convened a commission called the Committee on Recent Economic Changes.
Hmm.
And they pointed to advertising as a solution. And the quote from the report is quite amazing. It said, "A boundless field of new wants, which will make way endlessly for newer wants as fast as they are satisfied."
Hmm. Interesting.
So that was really, in other words, there really was a conscious effort to create a consumer society, and this was, even in the 30s, in fact, is when there was an ideological bent placed on that, because business did not like, or many of the business people did not like the New Deal, and they started a campaign called The American Way. And their overriding concern was they hoped to fight the New Deal, and they claimed that consumption was kind of like voting.
Hmm.
They politicized this
mm-hmm.
and said the marketplace was where citizens could find freedom, and government would only tie people down through bureaucracy and legal restrictions. It's really much of the rhetoric we hear today was fashioned in the 30s
mm-hmm.
around government versus the marketplace.
Hmm. And yet you had, and I want you to talk about this at some length because it's a wonderful society to imagine, you had this visionary alternative.
Right.
From the Kellogg Company, and they changed the work hours, and people had fuller lives at home and doing farming and with their
right.
neighbors. It was quite a thing. I knew nothing about that.
Right, right. And there was a marvelous book called Kellogg's Six-Hour Day that was put out by a fellow named Honeycutt that describes some of this in detail. And what Kellogg – I mean, there were multiple reasons, but what Kellogg did – is say, okay, we're going to have a six-hour day. We're going to have 4 6-hour shifts a day. Now, this is at a time when the 8-hour day was coming into somewhat, but a lot of people were still on 10-hour days. A lot depends on the industry. So this was really a radical notion then. And part of this was, of course, in the Depression, it could help save jobs. But they were really after much more than that. And Kellogg actually sent, or the management sent a letter out to, what do you call it, published, they called a personal letter to employees, and they said, they pointed to what you call the mental income of that one would have by having more time to be with family and at home. And he called this the enjoyment of the surroundings of your home, the place you work, your neighbors, other pleasures you have that are harder to translate into dollars and cents. And he thought the company would benefit from this because the community itself, would be, where the company was based, would be stronger as well. And this, I mean, this was not 6 hours work for 8 hours pay. He did try to soften the blow of lower wages a bit with production bonuses and stuff like that. But people did take somewhat of a cut in wages. And yet, there was both some journalists and the government interviewers came around and talked to these people, and they said they were happy with this.
Hmm.
They talked about how they were doing gardening and they were doing community beautification and so forth and so forth. And the report generally from both the Department of Labor survey and I don't know which magazine it was offhand, people liked it, as the great majority of people did. And one of the most important things was they could be with their children.
Right. Yes, yes.
And then this fellow, Professor Honeycutt, came in, and he did some interviews. And first I should say that this policy survived in some form to the mid-80s, although what happened was after the war, different management came in, and they started slicing at this. And so there were only a few holdouts that were termed the Mavericks that held out in a few departments where they could still do the six-hour day. So Honeycutt came in and he interviewed both older people who'd been there in the 30s and the last of the holdouts in the 80s. And one of the really, really interesting things about this to me was that both groups described the situation in using very much the same language. And this despite the fact that people in the 80s had tons more stuff or a higher standard of living than the people in the 30s did. And yet they both spoke about this in pretty much the same terms, which says to me that above a certain level of physical comfort, other things become more important.
Right, right.
So if you can, like, I can tell you a few more things that, you know, people did. They talked about, in fact, the amazing quote to me from some of the 1980s people was they talked about people who wanted to work tons of overtime as workhawks.
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 Huh.
They would, that in the sense that if somebody is working, you know, tons of overtime, it means somebody else isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And that impoverishes the community. because it, in fact, one person quoted, I think it was Toynbee. They said if we don't have more people working, we'll have to take care of the rest of us. We'll have to take care of the people that aren't working, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's much better to put them to work. And so they many of these people really pretty well understood the issues at hand, and they also pointed out to the fact that people, you know, went out for more money and bought more stuff. At the end, they were just as broke as ever.
Hmm.
So was
Kellogg an anomaly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wasn't the only one. There were a few other places that also did some work hours. It's not well documented, though. But for the most part, the direction was quite the opposite. There was some important books written in the 30s pointing out the danger of a consumer society. Almost everything we could think of, except for ecology, but that it would distort the American society in dangerous ways, and also hurt labor. And that book was really quite influential, and it got to the U.S. Senate, and the person especially of Hugo Black, who later became a Supreme Court justice.
Supreme Court, yeah.
And Black put out a 30-hour week work bill in Congress in the 30s. And it was sold largely, as a way to protect jobs. But the book itself that formed the background to that, you know, went pretty much similar ideas to what Kellogg was talking about. And initially Roosevelt supported it. And then under industry pressure, he withdrew that support, and we ended up instead with the 40-hour week that we supposedly observe today. So that there was, again, industry didn't like this one bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so really that period there was when there was this one of the two key places where there was a big shift. That was a shift in government policy. Okay, there was a later shift that came after the war, when the unions also began to say, "Okay, you know, we're going to go for this more work time, higher wages,
right,
and so forth."
Yeah. In the latest issue of Orion Nature Culture Place May June issue, "The Gospel of Consumption and the Better Future We Left Behind." The author is with us this hour of the program. We have yet to get to where we are now and how many hours the average American is working and how much we are consuming. All of that's coming up. And we want to welcome your phone calls, too. I don't want to forget about you. So call us on air, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Some of you may remember those days when the work weeks were shorter or the hours per day were shorter. Many of you can comment on the number of hours that you are working now and what it's doing to your family life and your home life, and in some cases to your health. So we'd like to. Oh, and then we got this, email system. So that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike Crane from Wisconsin Public Radio has joined me in our studios again, and we're back to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's easy to do. Just go online at WPR.org or call toll-free at 888-202-2552. Hello again, Mike.
It's good to be here, and we're about 10% of the way toward our goal for this hour. We have a goal of $3,500. That means that we need your help. So please call right now, and the number is 888-202-2552, or contribute online. It might be easier if you're listening to the radio to just take care of that by typing at WPR.org. And we heard from people all around the state. John from Superior says that he listens because you get knowledge that you can use. And George from Janesville says, "I listen to WPR exclusively. It's the only station tuned on all my radios."
Mm, great.
How about you? Is that something that you can understand and agree with? Then please get in touch right now.
There are places that you go to get the news quickly, the three-line summary of issues and events, and then there is public radio. And you tune to Wisconsin Public Radio each day because you need more than the headlines. The people who listen to this station are people who are smart, extremely informed. You need to hear the debate, and you need to understand the history, the background. You need enough information to make your own decision on an issue. You need Wisconsin Public Radio, and we need you. We need your support. So we ask you please to make your pledge now online at WPR.org or toll-free at 888-202-2552.
WPR enriches your life, and for a pledge of $120 or more, the WPR member card can add even more enrichment to your life, giving you savings at restaurants and B&Bs and cultural attractions throughout the state. And you may end up dining at restaurants or visiting places you hadn't thought of trying before because you're a member. Pledge your support right now, $120 or more, and in addition to just being a member, we'll send you the WPR member card. That's online at WPR.org or toll-free 888-202-2552.
It's important for you to stay informed of state, regional, and world events. And it's also important to find a place when you're burned out. We've had many a Friday when we've thought, we got to do a joke show on Monday because we're kind of burned out with the news, but we know that it's important that we present it. But you get comedy as well and entertainment. You can get information, commentary, and, of course, with our dear Nancy Pearl, our wonderful librarian, suggested reading. We also have programs that help you clear your mind and entertain you. Support the programming that you value securely online at WPR.org or toll-free at 888-202-2552.
You know, people ask, Kathleen, how much should I pledge? They're not really sure. We'll suggest something, and that is, how about just making the average pledge? That's about $120 over the course of a year or $10 a month. And those pledges really do add up. Together, listeners provide the most important source of funding for WPR. So please pledge your support right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And that's really how Wisconsin Public Radio operates. We ask you to become a member, and then your financial support makes this radio station possible. Over 40,000 people currently support WPR through their donations. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you for being one of them. But if you have not donated yet, please make the decision to do so now. You depend on hearing great programs on WPR. Please make a donation, a contribution to support this programming. Go to WPR.org, pledge securely online, or call toll-free 888-202-2552.
Please help us to raise that $3,500 this hour. It's a stretch goal, and we need you to help us stretch there with your call right now, 888-202-2552, or online at WPR.org. Join people like Liliana and Joel of Shorewood, who said, this is an outstanding radio station. It keeps us informed about the latest events. And Doris from Rylander says, it's the best thing on the radio.
Oh, I think it is, too. I really do. Thank you, Mike.
Good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you here. We'll talk to you a little bit later. Now we're going to go back to how hard we work. And we do. We work hard here, too. You know, we read the books. We are on top of what's going on in the world. And we're looking at how what's happened with the American workforce over the course of really the last century and into this century. Welcoming phone calls for our guest, Jeffrey Kaplan, a freelance writer and activist concentrating on the intersection of democracy, political economy, and ecology. And the piece that caught our attention is in Orion, Nature, Culture, and Place. And we start our calls with Kurt from Springbrook. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. Yeah, I read Jeffrey Kaplan's article in Orion, and it was stunning and had a big impact on my thought. I guess, you know, for me, industrialism has been a nightmare. I mean, we've seen depression in teens go up 1,000% in the past 50 years. You know, they're talking the Arctic ice shelf's going to be gone by 2013. We're watching 200 species a day go extinct, basically because of industrialism. So I've been reading a lot about the age of deindustrialization, and I was wondering, I'd like to hear your guests talk about that vision. What would that look like?
Okay. Well, I don't know that we're really going to get totally rid of, it depends how you define industrialism, I think. The notion that we're going to do everything with giant machines, of course, is probably on the way out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we'll do completely without machines, as one person said, one of the tricks is to turn them off when we have enough stuff. And that is the beginning, I suppose, of a form of deindustrialization. It's also true, this goes a little outside the realm of the article, but it's also true that probably the industrial model doesn't work for certain things. And certainly the case that I think most people are becoming aware of now is agriculture. And we may also be looking towards a world in which the machines we do use are smaller. They were not part of gigantic corporations that have national and global reach. So we're not shipping timber to Asia so they can ship it back to us as toothpicks. That's sort of an absurdity. So we will probably incorporate machines into our lives because I don't think we're going to be doing, I think, for example, electricity will be around for a while, but we may not use nearly as much of it, and we probably will produce it in very different ways than we do now.
Do you think we have the ability to shut the machines off? I mean, it seems like we can't put them down. Like a child can put their toys down when they're done, when they're sick of it. It just seems
like... Well, we may not have much choice.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the things we're looking at now. Even if the current turmoil calms down somewhat, it doesn't mean it's not going to come back. The question is, you know, how cleanly we can do this. Can we have what people like call a soft landing? Or there's tremendous institutional rigidity into changing it. So I think you are pointing to a real question. You know, is will we be able to do this in a rational manner, or will it get decided for us rather abruptly? And part of the reason I wrote the article is to look at one, you know, set of systemic relationships that we need to understand so that we have some way of thinking about this in a way that's not nearly so threatening. Oh, my God, I won't have, you know, 5 iPods and 10 pairs of shoes.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's other things to life besides that.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. And what else? You mentioned the shoes and the iPods. What kind of stuff are we buying?
Well, one thing I said is an outside observer might think we're kind of like King Midas and everything we touch turns into a product wrapped around a microchip. So we're buying tons of electronic gear, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We're buying all kinds of stuff. I think Kurt is right, though, that both structurally in terms of the powers that be don't want to change, and we also have a state of denial amongst ourselves. That's why I think it's a lot to explain this SUV phenomenon, where we're just going to get big and huge because, you know, the world looks like it's not going to let us do that, so the heck with that. But these days we buy almost anything. I mean, almost anything we go to the market to buy as a commodity. Almost anything and everything. Everything from those iPods to things that never were considered to be commodities before, like childcare. And one of the things the piece points to is that if we worked less, we'd be able to provide that in a more local community basis for a lot of the things we need. Some things will not be in the market anymore, or at least a lot less so, like childcare.
Right, yeah. That need to show that we're still big, that we're still powerful, I think what you said is interesting about our need to buy those SUVs. Has that abated at all as the gas prices are going through the roof?
I believe so. You know, although the fact that doesn't seem practical anymore, I don't know to what extent that has changed people's thinking about what they'd like to be able to do, where their priorities are. Again, that's why I wrote the article. I think, though, that time to be with our family is a huge, you might call it a third rail in American society.
Mm-hmm.
And the part of the problem is that it isn't just that people don't want to make that choice. The system isn't set up to make it very easy for them to make that choice. I mean, this is what happened to the people who were the mavericks at Kellogg in the 80s. They wanted to keep it, but eventually those departments were shifted to 8 hours, and many people lost their jobs. And so the market isn't set up to let us do this that easily. If you want to get it, you can get a part-time job, but usually it's working at a bookstore part-time for a little over minimum wage or something like that.
Right.
So really, one thing I'm pointing to is that we need really to think of this in terms of politically. I mean, the people who put this in place in the 30s knew they were acting on a political basis. And in fact, it was engineered largely by public relations people. It was then a new idea, public relations. But some of the people said, hey, we're going to have a world in which people's ideas and their priorities are going to be set by people they don't even know.
Hmm.
And this, they call this an invisible government.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to sort of think in terms of what we want as citizens. And in fact, some of the early labor organizers in the 19th century, when they were talking about what was then the radical notion of a 10-hour day, said that as citizens, we have duties to perform, and we need time to do that. And this is something that people are going to have to start thinking in terms of both their political life and their family life.
Right.
And also really put a stop to the commodification of politics itself. There was a quote from the Andrew Card, who was then the head of Reagan's chief of staff,
mm-hmm.
before they went to the Iraq War, and it turned out that they had planned this war in the summer, but they only announced it shortly before congressional elections in the fall, and they asked him why, and he said, "You don't roll out a new product in August."
Mm-hmm.
So we really need to rethink all our priorities and to realize that we're going to have to go to bat on a large scale for this, and not simply try to get it by looking for that part-time job.
Right. Nick from Dodge County, hi.
Hi, guys. I have an idea that I hope you'll research further in the future, and that is that we've lost consciousness of dollars per hour. We always think dollars per year. And, when I started working when I was 14 for a buck an hour, it was pretty easy to figure out your check. But I work for a Fortune 100 company. I've got two BAs and a master's degree. And I've consistently, I know I could be making more money per year, but I've consistently focused on dollars per hour. And, gosh, what's the true definition of success? To me, definition of success is that I work just about a 40.0-hour work week. And even a couple of months ago, I went to Colorado for the sixth year in a row, spent 10 days skiing with my family, did not check email, did not check voicemail.
Hmm.
Now, that's my definition of success. And if people would think more about dollars per hour, including their commuting time has to be in there, boy, I bet they'd get quite an eyeful, or I'd be a real eye-opener for people.
I wasn't clear on one thing. You're working the 40 hours a week?
Yep,
you're not working overtime.
I limit myself, though I realize I could have been promoted and went further.
Ah, yes. Yeah, I mean, a lot of people... one of the ways in which the 40-hour work week has been subverted, obviously, is salaried positions, which have expanded.
Yes.
used to be management, and now they've sort of expanded it so that many jobs, anything out of manufacturing practically, is a salaried position, which means you work as much.
I thought Lincoln freed the slaves, but, boy, it's...
Yeah, so in that sense, yes.
So anyway, that's my comment.
I hope you'll do more research
on dollars per hour.
Yeah, I mean, that the 40-hour work week and 8-hour day has been undermined.
Right. You include this figure in the article, Jeffrey. By 2000, the average married couple with children were working almost 500 hours a year, more than in 1979.
Right.
That's amazing.
Right. And of course, part of what happened was in addition to rising expectations, we also had, as the caller pointed out, we also, despite dollars per hour, the real wages per hour have been declining since the 70s. And so what happened was people went to two-earner families.
Right.
Because when I was young, one blue-collar job could support a family of four.
Mm-hmm.
And then it went from there, people went to two-earner families and then into debt.
Let's give the phone number and invite you to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Jeffrey Kaplan is our guest, freelance writer and activist concentrating on the intersection of democracy, political economy, and ecology. And we're talking about his piece that appears in the May-June issue of Orion, Nature, Culture, Place. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls for Jeffrey. Barbara from Madison is next. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Kathleen, and welcome back. It's so nice to hear your voice, and I wish you well.
Thank you, Barbara.
You know, I'm 82 years old. I grew up in that time of the Great Depression, and honestly, as I look back on it, it truly has affected me totally in my consumption now. I try to live without consuming a lot of things. And when I go in these stores and I see all this stuff, and I wonder, are there going to be trash dumps big enough to dispose of all mm-hmm. this stuff? And people think that they need this and work endlessly for these humongous houses and how their children are buying habits are formed by all this is pretty depressing to me, that people are just prisoners of their stuff. I say travel lightly and leisurely and spend more time with your family and give up some of this stuff. And then I also want to comment on what the automobile manufacturers, of course we love our automobiles, but boy, they destroyed our public transit system here and in many cities so that people would have to buy automobiles to get where they needed to go. It's just a kind of a hard thing for me to see what it's done to our present-day families.
You want to respond, Jeffrey?
Well, first of all, I have to say, I'm not 82, but I grew up with parents who were similarly affected, as Barbara was, by the Depression. So I understand that feeling, and some of it was inculcated to me in the sense of don't run after all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Time is really important and things like that. I want one little sidelight on what you said about cars. In the 30s, the New York World's Fair of 1939 was actually put up as part of this big PR campaign, and General Motors had a giant Futurama exhibit where they had something called Democracy City, and they actually modeled this world they were going to create that Barbara talks about with automobiles coming from distant suburbs into the skyscraper-packed city where their jobs would be. This was before such a thing existed. So this was really, again, something that was envisioned.
And it was viewed by an enormous number of people, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, the New York World's Fair was this major event in American cultural history. And it celebrated the merger, you might say, of technology and society with a corporate, but it was also seen directly as corporate propaganda to counter the New Deal.
Right, yeah. Barbara, thank you so much for your call. When was it? In what year? Because I can remember doing talk shows. I've done a lot of years of talk shows. But I can remember doing quite a few talk shows of, that four-day work week is right around the corner. You just wait. Next year, we're going to have a four-day work week.
Right. Well, that talk started in the 20s.
Hmm.
And they were talking about three-day work weeks, potentially, because they looked around and said, gosh, like man said, 14% of the factories can make all the shoes.
Right.
And instead, we said, no. What you need is your regular shoes for work. And
right.
You need your tennis shoes, and then you need your cross-country training shoes, and, on it goes.
Right. I remember when I was a kid, we had two pairs of shoes. We had tennis shoes, and then we had our school shoes.
Right.
That
right. Well, now you need cross-training shoes.
Right. Right. Let's go to Lee next from Eau Claire. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is on mandatory overtime that's enforced these days, that if you don't do it, you'll get fired. I recently had a night job where we had to go in 70 hours a week.
Ooh.
So that was 6 days a week for 12 hours.
Wow.
Well, guess I was making a reference to the 1830s when workers were demanding a 10-hour day, and in some degrees were going backwards. I think one thing I didn't cover in this article, because there just wasn't space, was the effect of benefits and stuff on employers. In other words, we tie our health benefits and pension to employment, which means that it's tougher for even a well-intentioned rather than perhaps a rather mean-spirited employer to hire more workers. And so at this point, that's even seen as a an albatross around the employer's neck, that we're one of the few industrialized countries that tie those kinds of things to a specific job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably part of the reason for this mandatory overtime, is that hiring more workers is also more expensive. But I wouldn't be surprised to find that in the heart of hearts there is a tenet, to realize that there was a time when keeping people at work for 10, 12 hours a day or more was what employers thought was their advantage,
right,
regardless of the effect on its employees. And I don't think that impulse has really gone away. It was the labor movement that fought very hard to change things.
Do you have some other place to go, Lee? That just seems like too much.
Oh, I quit that job.
Okay, well,
good. It was night shift, so my one day off, I wouldn't get up until noon and then have about 6 hours to spend with my family for the week,
Right, yeah. That sounds like, early 19th century kind of
right.
work conditions.
But this was by a multinational company that, tries to promote itself as being, a good player in the industrial world.
Right.
Well, that's what the employers in the 19th century said about themselves, too.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Dave from Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Great show, and it's something that I've talked about plenty of times with family. I'm in contact with a friend of mine in Europe, in Holland. We stay at each other's houses over the years, and as we were getting to know each other, we always compared our lives, things that went on our daily lives. And when I would tell him about the work hours here, everybody I knew worked 50, 60 hours a week, he absolutely could not believe it. I mean, he thought that I was not telling him the truth. And explained to me how, a 30-hour week in Holland is a full-time job, 6-hour days. And the first two questions he asked were, well, how do you go spend time with anybody, or how do you go do anything? And the second question was, is it because everybody is so greedy? It really sunk in during a family reunion this past year when we were bringing things up. I was sitting talking to a cousin and a brother of mine, and my cousin had said that she was working two jobs now, and she lost one of her jobs. And the first thing I said, because I kind of pushed this thing, first thing I said to her was, well, that's great. You get to spend more time with your family. And you would not believe the looks. They could have cracked both of their necks snapping at me I was just out of my mind.
Oh, my. We have a whole lot to think about in terms of visioning a different America. Jeffrey, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, very thought-provoking article. Jeffrey Kaplan, and it's in Orion, Nature, Culture, Place for the May-June issue. I'm joined in the studio now by Mike Crane in from Madison, and we are back to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's easy to do. All you have to do is go online at WPR.org, or you can call us toll-free at 888-202-2552. Hi, Mike.
It's good to be here. And noticing how Dave kind of helped us wrap up a fascinating hour of conversation, and I like what he said, Dave, from Michigan. He said, great show. And it really has been another fantastic hour, and we invite you to help us to raise the dollars needed to pay for that great show. $3,500 is our goal for the hour, and we've raised about $530, so we need a real, just a bunch of phone calls
right now.
A bunch of web pledges. The phone number is 888-202-2552, 888-202-2552, or if you're at work and you don't want to talk right now, just Open up a web browser and type WPR.org and make your secure online pledge right there.
Wisconsin Public Radio is full of great stories, and you have a chance to tell your stories right here. The great stories you hear are what keep you coming back day after day, and I ask how many times the past week you've told a friend or a family member about a great story that you heard on Wisconsin Public Radio. Stories that you hear here are worth sharing. They inform you, they enlighten you, and they often make you smile or laugh or sometimes cry. Pledge your support for great stories. Here's to great stories. Donate at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, you've heard us say it couldn't be easier millions of times, I'm sure. But in the case of contributing to Wisconsin Public Radio, it really is true. All you have to do is go online to WPR.org or pick up the phone and call 888-202-2552, and in just a few seconds you'll be making your pledge, and then it will just take a few more seconds for it to be complete. So go online right now, WPR.org, or call 888-202-2552. No matter how much you do in terms of a dollar amount, it all counts. So please get in touch with Wisconsin Public Radio right now.
Your membership to Wisconsin Public Radio supports a valuable community resource. WPR provides a forum for discussion of the issues that really do matter to you in the community, and there are so many important issues right now. Basically, listening to this station, to WPR, helps you to stay an engaged and informed citizen. And now we're asking you to be an active citizen by supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. It's something we need to tell you, that you can't take this service for granted. Pledge online at WPR.org or by phone at 888-202-2552.
You know, if your budget could afford it, then we would ask you to consider a gift of
$1,000. Yeah, that'd be great.
Your generous leadership contribution, that would be $83 a month, by the way, and $1,000 over a year's time, will help us to bring WPR programming to those who cannot afford to give. Of course, some people listening,
right,
it's not the right time, and we understand that. But if it's the right time for you, whether it's $10 or $1,000, please get in touch right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Over the past decades, you've learned about so many topics, it's hard to imagine all the topics from Wisconsin Public Radio. You've learned everything from the latest political controversy to how to grow perennials, from the latest classical recording to what leading artists are saying. Wisconsin Public Radio is here for you, watching for the latest information on topics that are of deep interest to you. So we ask that you invest in your future listening and donate now. Securely online at WPR.org or toll free at 888-202-2552.
And we want to thank a few people. Sandra and Robert from Oconomowoc said Kathleen Dunn is one of the best people on radio. We have WPR on all day long because it's an intelligent station. And Julie from La Crosse said, you know, I'm pledging because I need to support my addiction. And so if it's an addiction to radio, that's a pretty healthy one. You're getting smarter every day.
Yeah.
And thank you for getting in touch. WPR.org to make your online secure pledge or call 888-202-2552.
You listen to the discussion of current events on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio to hear all sides and to understand the why behind complicated issues.
I like the broad spectrum that they give.
A variety of viewpoints and ideas on many, many different topics that we might not learn about otherwise.
Support the spectrum of discussions you hear with your pledge of financial support. Here's the number.
Mike Crane is here with me in our studios. We're back to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. As the minutes dwindle down this hour, we ask you to go to WPR.org or call toll-free 888-202-2552.
And we'd love to hear from you right now.
We sure would.
Our goal is $3,500 for this hour, and we've just got a few minutes left and still about $3,000 to raise. So it's been a little slower than we need. That means we need your help. Call right now, 888-202-2552, or contribute online at WPR.org. Org.
And if you think about it for a minute, many of you come here for the latest news. You don't go to TV. Many of you actually go to a lot of places, news magazines, newspapers. You do go to those places. But the biggest source of information and conversation and community is Wisconsin Public Radio. We come to you without any upfront cost. There are no subscriptions to pay, no cable bills to take care of every month. And yet significant programs do come with significant costs. Coverage of world and national news is expensive, so in order to cover those costs, we come to you. Please contribute online, WPR.org, or at 888-202-2552.
Your contribution in any amount will help to pay for all of the great programming that you hear. What an incredible day we've already had. 5 hours of amazing conversations with you involved, and it's made possible by you. So please log on to WPR.org and make your contribution online or call toll-free 888-202-2552, and you'll speak to someone who can take your pledge. No matter how you contribute, your pledge helps us to do the essential work of keeping you informed, entertained, and engaged each day. Call 888-202-2552 or go to WPR.org.
Thanks very much, Mike Crane, for coming in from Madison, and thanks everybody for pledging this morning. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour's program, and to John Treader, our faithful volunteer, for on-air production, and we'll be with you again tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.